Accession number 18037, Reel 1.
Mr. Bill Titcomb, yes. On October the 12th, 1989.
Okay, we're ready.
You ready?
Yes.
Well, I started at Vickers Aviation in, I think it was August or September in 1919. And I was taken on by Rex Pearson, who later was becoming Sir Keith Rex Pearson. He took me on. We went to Pinewood House from the front entrance to meet Paul Wyand, who was the chief draftsman. That Pinewood House was a house which had, an ordinary house, which had been taken over by the design office when they moved down from London. It was an ordinary house, and we just occupied the various rooms.
Where was it in relation to the Brooklyn site?
Relation to the Brooklyn?
Was it on the Brooklyn site, Pinewood House?
No. There was a little turning which went off the Weybridge Road or the Brooklands Road, around the back, a little lane, and there were several private houses there. There was one opposite which was occupied by a private family. There was one on the corner which was later turned into a lodging house. Maxwell Muller lived in another one there, because he lived in this Pinewood House originally. He moved out to the other house. Those two were owned by the firm. The upstairs was the drawing office, various rooms, and Pearson had an office up there. Paul Wyand, the chief draftsman, had an office. Tommy Duncan had another office, and he had a draftsman working with him. I think his name was Oscar Brack. He was a Belgian, but he was a marvellous draftsman. And then in the other rooms, you've got people like George Stannard, you've probably heard of, Dan Wakeford, Jess McKenna, Sid Ebel, Furman, Fred Jupp, Ernie Birch, and then there was Tracers there as well. There was a Miss Biggs who came from Weybridge, Miss Sherman, Wilf Hurley, and a deaf and dumb bloke the name of Michael Marshall. They were the Tracers. It was just an ordinary house. There was one WC upstairs, just the WC, and there was one downstairs. Now downstairs the kitchen would be turned into a print room, and a woman by the name of Ivy Jelly used to operate the print room. That was blueprints in those days, and they had to be printed and then washed and then dried in a gas oven. Several people used to visit Ivy unofficially, being rather an attractive girl. One day the chief draftsman thought, there's somebody down there, but I better go and see. They heard him come down the stairs because he was a bit heavy, rushed into this place, and the bloke that was there got into the oven. Nearly got cooked. So, anybody down here, Ivy? And she said, no, Mr. Wyand, nobody here. No, you off you went. Bloke came out the oven, nearly cooked. One of the items that happens in their place.
Could I ask you briefly the context of the work? The First World War had finished.
Yes, only just.
The RAF wasn't buying any more aeroplanes.
No.
So what was the main work you were doing there?
Well, they'd still got a lot of Vimy stuff there, and they were converting Vimy into a commercial Vimy. Furman was designed the cabin of that, or the fuselage actually, which was an oval shaped timber constructed fuselage. And the rest was Vimy stuff, wings, tower, plane, engine mount, all the rest of it was just ordinary bomber stuff. And then they went on to flying boats, Vikings, Wildebeest, and various things of that description. But that's
sorry,
all.
I interrupted you, but carry
that's
on.
All shown in the book that was written by Charlie Andrews, which you've probably seen. Mm-hmm. Vickers Aircraft. You know that one, do you?
Yes, yes.
Well, that's all the aircraft that were done. Now, I think I worked on pretty well all the aircraft in some capacity or other, right from those days, right up till I retired. Well, I left early, actually. I left when I was 60. And
but when I wanted that?
Pardon?
When, what year was that?
Sure, well, that was 25 years ago. When would that be?
yes, 1964, is it?
Something like that, yeah. Yes. I think it was 1964. Hmm. And I was working... The Concorde was just evolving when I left. I did a little bit on it, not very much, relative to... ball bearings, which I was trying to standardise. I was on the standards committee at that time. We used to travel about trying to standardise aircraft bearings. what else do we want now? Down the stairs in the Pinewood House was the the stress office. The chief stressman was Sammy Seabrook. You've probably heard of him. And it was Frank Richards and Hall and Beadle and one or two more, which I don't remember the names of. And there was a billiard room at the back which was used for lunches, and we used to play table tennis there. At the time when I joined the firm, they were just building a foundry, because Tommy Duncan was designing fuel cocks, and they were made of all things brass in those days, and they were going to cast their own brass fuel cocks and petrol pumps and things like that, because the aircraft used to use propeller driven or windmill driven centrifugal pumps, and he used to design those, and that was all quite interesting. Then after that they built a 4 foot wind channel at the back of the drawing office. Well, I'd be in the odd boy sort of business in the I was the only lad in the design organisation really in those days, and a local lad.
It was a wind tunnel, was it? Or
it was a wind channel. They called it the channel, but it was only a 4 foot. Mm. And there was a man named Mounter in charge of it. He came from the NPL. That I was taken over there to help him fit up the instruments in the channel, because they had the balances and things had to be fitted up, and he knew all about it, and I had to give him a hand on that. There was another job I did while I was in the early days.
What drove the channel itself? Did you have
electrical.
It was electric
big,
motor, was it?
A big propeller driven by an electric motor. And the electricity was generated on site in the powerhouse there. And of course, before they could switch on the wind tunnel, they had to inform the man in the in charge of the power station that they were going to use a hell of a lot of electricity. He had to sort of switch on something or boost something up to get the power through. They also, when they started making these Viking aircraft, all the fittings, the metal fittings, had to be galvanised against seawater, electro-galvanised. They hadn't got a plant in the factory for that sort of thing, But Tommy Duncan designed a galvanising plant which was erected in the old canteen. And I had to go and operate it. He instructed me how to do it, and I used to, I galvanised quite a number of Viking fittings in those days. That was the more or less the early stages of the process department, which got quite big in the end. So I don't know what else you'd like to know about. You'd like to ask some questions?
Yeah, I'd like, if I may, can I go back a little bit further and ask you, you know, where you were born, where you went to school,
yes,
what
okay.
your father did, all that sort
yes.
of stuff?
Well, I was born in Walton-on-Thames, but at the time I joined the firm, I was living in Byfleet, and my father was the village policeman. And he knew the people up there quite well, because he used to visit, he had contact with Archie Knight and people like that, and that's I suppose why I managed to get into that into there, because I had been working for Tarrant's on the Tabor. That was my first job, because I left school I suppose in the summer holidays before I was 14, because I wasn't 14 till the 29th of August. But the school shut down at the end of July, sort of, is for the summer holidays. And I went and got a job at Tarrant's, because we knew, everybody knew W.G. Tarrant, and he used to look after the local lads. He used to give them all a job.
Where was the factory?
In Byfleet.
In Byfleet.
Where the seatbelt people now are.
Was that Kangle's?
Eh?
Is it Kangle, the seatbelt?
Yeah, yes. And they built a big place there, and they had a design office there of over 100 people.
Mm.
And I was there as a tracer in the early days.
What did they manufacture?
They just made one Tarrant table. I've got a picture of it over there on the table.
I'm very ignorant. Is that a car or an aeroplane?
An aeroplane. You have a look at it. It's a big aeroplane. It's on the table there on cardboard.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And there's the...
A triplane?
Yes. Six-engine. That was built 1918. Somebody from the History Museum has got the information about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give them that picture ultimately.
Mm. This was a sort of rival to the Vimy, was it? It was built as a bomber or...?
Oh, it was built as a bomber or a troop carrier.
Mm.
It would carry a 100 fully armed troops.
Really?
Oh yes, it was a huge thing, and the fuselage was quite a large diameter. I walked down that fuselage.
And it flew?
No, it crashed on takeoff, unfortunately, because the engineer was down below and the pilot was up above, and there was a misunderstanding between the two, and when they were taking off, the engineer opened the top engines full blast, and the others were ticking over, and it pulled the nose over and dug it in the ground. There's a picture of it there, where it crashed. Where it crashed.
I see.
At Farnborough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of that was built at Byfleet, and the fuselage wasn't made in sections. It was made in one long fuselage, and that had to be towed from Byfleet to Farnborough with a traction engine on a special trolley. And my father, being a local policeman, had to cycle in front of this to direct the little traffic there was in those days past this tremendous thing that was being towed along the road.
And it was 73 feet long, I see.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, when that crashed, that more or less closed up the factory, and everybody had to find jobs elsewhere, and that's why I went along to the Vickers Aviation.
Now, at school, I mean,
normal school,
you were a draftsman. You became a draftsman.
Yes.
Presumably, you developed that talent at school, did you? Or?
No. Just had a normal school in. I did go up to Battersea to evening classes twice a week, sponsored by the firms for evening classes to learn a bit about things I didn't learn at the ordinary school. But I didn't go to any special school or anything, and just got most knowledge after I left school.
Going back to Pinewood House, what were the sort of conditions of work in those days compared to the days when you retired from the company? You know, well, how did they compare?
It was a bit crowded, and it wasn't bad. They were all friendly, and everybody got on all right with everybody. Where later on, of course, it got much too big and got very impartial.
Impersonal, yeah. And what time in the morning did you have to arrive? When what were the office hours?
I think they were 9 o'clock, I think. 9 till 5:30. And Saturday mornings, of course. We used to work Saturday mornings.
They were still fairly leisurely hours then for those days.
Oh, it wasn't too bad. But the wages were small, of course. I started there. Well, I started at W.G. Tarrant's at 7 shillings and 6 pence a week. When I went to Vickers Armstrong's, Vickers Aviation in those days, I got 10 shillings a week, which was pretty good, because the first-class senior draftsman in those days only used to get about £5 a week. That was a good wage in those days. And they used to leave one firm to another firm to get £5 to 5 shillings a week. I even went from Byfleet to Brough in Yorkshire for an extra £5.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
And how did you get to work? Were you near enough to walk?
Oh, bicycle.
Bicycle.
Yes. Mm. Yes, I was on bicycle. Then I left, when we left Byfleet, because my father was moved from various places in Surrey, being a policeman, and we lived at Egham for a time. And Chiddingfold and Bagshot. At, I got a car at some period in my time, and I used to either travel back to Woods by car or go into digs locally in Byfleet.
And I suppose the roads were fairly free of traffic in those
days. Oh, yes, hardly anything. And most people used to cycle anyway. We had a cycle racks were in the back sort of business, and that was it.
And were the roads made up, or do they have tarmac in that?
Oh, I think they were. I think, now there was quite a lot of the roads were dust roads, you know, were just ordinary gravel roads. But roads like the Portsmouth Road that ran through Ripley, that was, I think that had been tarmacked. That was the main A3. But the other roads, I think, they were a little bit... Because there wasn't any six cross roads at Woking. It was just... you just take your chance by rushing across.
And can you tell me something about the different aeroplanes you worked on? Because you went through a tremendous contrast in your working life from the village of
Concord.
Oh,
yes. Well, as I say, when they first... after the war, they were looking round for various things, and they did this Vimy commercial, which was quite a useful thing. I think Edgestone Airlines had the first Vimy commercials. And as I say, the fuselage was designed by Raf Furman, with the assistance of other people, of course. And all the wings and the rest of it was all part of the Vimy, because they had a big stock of Vimy bits and pieces, and they had to use them up.
Did you have anything to do with the Alcock and Brown Vimy, or was it just...
No, that was just before my time. That was in July, wasn't it?
Mm.
When they flew the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was brought back to the works to be repaired and put right, and it was on view down in the sports field at one of their sports days. I've got a picture of it somewhere. But then, of course, it went up to the Science Museum.
Did you ever meet Alcock and Brown? Did they visit the factory?
Oh, yes. They came down soon while I was there, and we all met them and cheered them, and they gave us half day's holiday. So we all had a half day's holiday, the whole factory.
And what impression did they make on you? Because you were a youngster in those days.
Oh, well, it was quite an achievement. And we were quite thrilled with the fact that the aeroplane had been built at Weybridge and flown at Brooklands and taken to bits, and several of the blokes that went over to Newfoundland were still in the factory, you see. They were still there working on their ordinary jobs. There was a chap named Bill Montague who was quite a youngster. I think he was, when he left school, he went straight into the factory. But he's gone now. I think he went out with them to Newfoundland. But it was quite an achievement. When you realise that probably that was about the only aeroplane flying at the time when they flew across the Atlantic.
Really?
The air was completely... They were completely on their own sort of business. Amazing.
Mm.
And of course, they had radio, but I think that packed up halfway across.
Jeff Montgomery told me about his father, Gordon's involvement. I don't know if you ever met Gordon Montgomery, did you?
Oh, yes, I did. Mm. Yes. He was in charge of the erecting shop. And in the end, he was in charge of brick-making machines and things like that. When they started diversifying, when they didn't seem to want any more aircraft, they built some brick machines there.
Did the Depression have a bigger effect on the factory, or did they somehow keep going?
No, they kept going, because it wasn't all that big. I forget how many people worked there, but there wasn't an awful lot there. Maxwell Muller, of course, was the boss, and Edmonds was in charge of the fitters, and the biggest department, of course, was the carpenters. And they had quite a good stock of timber there, and they used to saw it up and prepare it and all the rest of it and store it properly, and that was very, very useful.
And who were the pilots in those days, in the 20s that we're talking about?
Cockrell, I think, was one. Broom and Cockrell. Yeah, I think it was
before Muck Summers' time, anyway, wasn't it?
No, it was before Muck Summers, yeah. Long time before him.
Did you have a lot of contact with the flight test department?
Not a lot, no. No, that was nothing to do with us, really. We were concerned with design and getting on with the design, which wasn't always easy. When Sir Barnes Wallis arrived in the place, you know, they were a bit sort of concerned about him to start with, but he was a very clever bloke, but a very difficult bloke to work for.
Why in particular?
He wanted everything absolutely just so. I know once on one of the jobs I was doing, because he had to okay everything that was done in the drawing office at one time. In other words, he had to almost look at every drawing that was done, which took a hell of a long time. And of course, the chief draftsman was frantic to get the work out into the shops. Well, I was doing a rush job, and they had to bring Wallace into it. He came and sat on my stool, looked at it and said, when I was a young man, I used to take a pride in my work, and I don't think much of that. You better redraw it and make a decent job of it. Well, it was a bit scrappy. I'd altered it once or twice, but the boss came down. I said, what did he say? I said, he wants me to redraw it. Oh, blast the man, he said. We want to get it done. Get on with it. Get it out quick. That was the sort of bloke he was. It had to be right.
Did you have to work sort of long hours to meet a deadline like that? Did you work on into the night to get it right for the next morning? Or?
No, we used to do a bit of overtime, but not a lot. I wasn't all that keen on overtime, personally. And Wyant, the chief draftsman, said one of his statements, if you want to make the job last, put them on overtime. It means the day is extended, but you don't get any more done.
Yeah.
He was quite right. So,
can you recall any unusual incidences in your work in the drawing office?
I don't think so. Nothing very special.
What about some of the characters?
Well, they were all characters on their own. George Stoud was a... We used to call him the father of the office because he came down from a London office. Reg Furman, he was one of the earliest ones. You've probably heard about him.
I've spoken to him. Well, I did before he sadly died.
Because he started life at Joyce Green. And they reckon that when he first started work at 14, he was in short trousers. Well, in those days, they didn't put him in long trousers. Now they put him in long trousers almost as soon as they go to school. Who else was a character? Fred Jupp, of course, was a character. Now, he was invalided out of the First World War because he had been a pilot and he got damaged, he got shot down and he was damaged. And he was one of the early ones there. And as far as I know, he's still alive down in the Isle of Wight. And another bloke, the name of Sid Ebel, he is still alive and he's down in the West Country somewhere. And there's only the three of us now that are survivors from the Pinewood days.
And you're now 86, are you?
85.
85.
Coming 86. Well, on the 86th year, I suppose they say. I say it's 58. I don't say it's 85. It's 58.
That's what you feel
said,
like.
Somebody the other day said, how old are you now? I said, 58. I said, and the rest? I said, oh, well, you can fiddle about the numbers. I know Matt Summers was taken off on one little aeroplane that we did called the Jockey. It was designed by John Buescher, and you had to go through the gate on the engine to get full power for takeoff. Well, he went across the track and wasn't taken off. They all got very concerned about it, but he just managed to pull it up over the banking in the end. And John Buescher was very concerned about it. He said, what the hell's the man doing? And when he came back and landed all right, he said, why did you take so long on the takeoff? Oh, he said, he just wouldn't go. He said, you go through the gate. He said, what gate? Well, he had to go a bit more on the throttle to get the full power. But he didn't know anything about them, although he'd been looking at the aircraft while it was being assembled. He didn't seem to know anything about it. And he was one of those, well, we always used to think he was a bit of a slap-happy pilot. But unfortunately, their little Venom that wasn't all that stable, it had got rather a shallow rear fuselage, and the tailplane tended to rotate a bit. It was unstable in flight. Well, when...
Which aeroplane was this? The Venom, you said?
No, this was the Jockey.
The Jockey, yeah.
Which was an earlier... That was the first one.
Yeah.
There was two done. There was the Venom, and there was a cowgun fighter with a big gun up the front. But the Jockey was designed by John Bucher, and designed and drawn up by about four people. I was one of them. So, as Paul Wine used to say, you and your gang of boys, because we were all youngsters, but I'm the only one left of that gang now. That when Sir Barnes Wallace came, his first job was to redesign that and put a monocoque rear fuselage. And then it was turned into the Venom.